bullpens, we're called inconsistency?
No, they're consistent. They just suck.
Really the bat, I think, that justifies the hype and the bonus just in terms of the strength that he has and the quickness and whip and his bat speed.
And pretty much every time the ball goes in the air in basketball, something exciting is happening. That's the rules of that game, as I understand it. And welcome to episode number 21 of Artificial Turf Wars, where our hitters shift on the defense. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined tonight by Josh Housem. How is Joshua this evening?
I'm good. How about you?
Oh, good. We're back from the All-Star break. Jays have been on the road, literally the only time they've been on the road all July, which is just weird. And I don't think we knew that last week, that it would be that weird. So I apologize for all the people we misled about the schedule. This week, we're going to talk about that road trip a little bit, the problems with the bullpen. What is Stroman, an enigma wrapped in a mystery? Will the Blue Jays be in first place by the time you listen to this? I don't know when you're listening to this. There's some people coming back that are going to help get into first place. We have an interview regarding the trade deadline speculation.
It's more about prospects that could be involved in potential trade deadline deals.
Fair enough. It all depends on your perspective. We, of course, have the usual raft of questions. A do-over for John Paul Morosi. And Josh is going to tell you why you should cheer for the Yankees. Stick around for that. I'm excited.
So, yes. It's tongue in. No, it's totally legit.
Yeah, absolutely. So
just before we get going, I would like to apologize because last week I suggested the Jays play the Mariners and the Padres on the road. That is obviously completely wrong. They will be here for Kevin Pillar bobblehead day on Sunday. So, yes, for everyone that pointed that out, my bad.
I would like to accept the apology on behalf of all of our listeners whom I did not help out by correcting you. So the only five games in July that the Blue Jays played on the road, and that feels really weird saying that, but Mike Wilner said it today after the game, the Jays went 3-2, 1-2 in Oakland, salvaging the final game of the series because Josh Donaldson wanted to punish his former team, I presume. And then they just wrecked the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Yeah, they did.
They were pretty much, after about the third inning of each game, they weren't in either game.
Yeah, I mean, the first one looked like it had potential to be something just, you know, because of some recent lack of performance when it comes to holding leads. But yeah, they did what they were supposed to do against the second of the two bad teams.
Yes. Do you want to touch on how I think the Blue Jays slogan should include never Oakland, just never go, never go there. You can play them, but don't ever go to the Oco. I cannot remember a series that they came out of Oakland and I felt good about what had just happened there.
Now watch, we'll go back and find out they swept in there last year or something like that.
I believe actually they got swept in a 4-game series last year. I could be wrong.
There you go. But no, I mean, it's, with its crazy dimensions, it's a park that can do weird things to you, especially if you're a team that's built on power the way the Blue Jays are. Although they didn't really have a ton of trouble scoring runs in that series. I mean, they scored 7 runs, 4 runs, and then 5 runs in the 3 games.
And they gave up a decent number of home runs. Like, it wasn't trouble for the Oakland batters. A team that is just abysmal at hitting didn't have any trouble scoring runs either.
No. No, they didn't.
So, Arizona is a team that is run by a whole crew that appears to be very tied up in the old school mentality. So, Dave Stewart is GM. Tony La Russa, what is his official title? Is he
president?
President, just president. Chip Hale is the field manager. And Chip Hale couldn't possibly be anything but old school with a name like that. They look like a team that is about to be left in the dust of a lot of other teams for a long time when I look at the guys they have on that roster.
Well, I mean, talk about a screw up management of a team too. I mean, they traded the number one overall pick, their first round pick from 2 years ago, and another good player in Inciarte for a guy they just optioned to the minors, Shelby Miller.
That's so bad. That's just, that's burning money and talent all at the same time. It's tough to do both. Usually you burn one or the other, right? When you sign a free agent or when you trade somebody.
But it's funny too, because you look at this team, it's like they've got Gene Segura, who's hitting really well. I mean, he seems to have rediscovered himself. Paul Goldschmidt is Paul Goldschmidt, and Jake Lamb is crushing the ball. But the rest of their team just isn't good.
No. I mean, they picked up Michael Bourne, and he's playing every day, isn't he?
He's back second.
This was a guy who was DFA'd by two different teams in the last 2 years, if I'm not mistaken.
No, no, no. Two different teams this year.
This year?
Well, so...
Okay, well, that's enough thoughts about Arizona. Arizona and the Twins are birds of a feather, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. Twins who just fired their GM finally. I mean, there's no reason that Terry Ryan lasted as long as he did, but it seems like they're finally realizing, hey, this isn't working right. But this is a Blue Jays podcast, so we'll get back to that a bit. It was interesting watching like Darwin Barney hit a ball at the top of the fence in left center field. I mean, the ball must really fly in Arizona.
It's a strange environment. It's one of the higher elevation parks. It's not mile high, but I remember it is like one of the top five elevations in MLB, and that does have some effect. I'm sure the heat.
It is a massive home run park, too. I mean, it was sort of tongue in cheek saying it must fly because it does.
I'm sure the heat doesn't hurt it at all either. The constant oppressive heat outside. They cool the ballpark to 80. That's air conditioned.
Yeah. Anyway, so.
So the Blue Jays did have a 3-2 road trip. And once again, the issue that was revealed was the bullpen's, we'll call it inconsistency?
No, they're consistent. They just suck. I mean, in the first game, Stroman had a meltdown, which we'll get to in a bit. But then, of course, they gave up a run to lose. The second game, it was, the bullpen was fine. Third game, Chavez comes in, blows the game. And then yesterday, or this recording this, obviously, for after the second game of Arizona, Sanchez went 7. And then they went Grilly, Osuna, the two guys who can get it done. And then today, Stroman went 8. And they still gave up 3 runs in the 9th because Cecil still sucks. I mean, it's shocking how bad he has been, even since coming off the DL.
Yep. He had found his curveball, but apparently he lost something else.
I mean, he was the guy that was supposed to make this bullpen go. You had Osuna, who was going to be the closer, and everybody knew that. And then you drop down to Cecil in the 8th and Storen. I mean, obviously Storen hasn't been good, but there were other relievers, righties, that could take over, like Floyd or Chavez or whomever. But the one lefty they were counting on was Brett Cecil, and he's just been objectively bad.
Yes. And there, every time I think, okay, well, this is an outing to start putting it on the right track, he, even if it doesn't, in garbage time, like it was today, he gets an out, he allows 2 singles, and boom, home run. And he's out of the game because Mr. Gibbons isn't going to let him sort it out there on the mound, and it's suddenly not garbage time anymore. But there's been a lot of runs in every possible situation from Brett Cecil. An out here and then a run there. And you can't... I'm shocked that this team is still in as good a shape it is without a lefty in the bullpen that Gibbons wants to give the ball to.
Yeah, and obviously the other option that could be coming is Franklin Morales, but even he's not doing that well in Buffalo, and I wouldn't be shocked if they just released him because he can only stay down for a few more days because then his rehab assignment won't be up and he can't be optioned.
That's a bitter pill.
Yeah, so, I mean, who knows? I mean, but the left-handed relief is definitely something this team needs to address because it's just been terrible.
And that might come up later in the interview. I don't know. Stroman is also one of the weak spots that this team has had with his ERA over 5 until today. And you were looking into his adjustments and then sudden lack thereof.
I mean, it was really interesting. So Marcus Stroman, obviously, as everyone knows, has had his struggles this season. It's not a secret. Don't really need to go into that too much. But one of the things we talked about was his you know, his predictability when it came to his pitches. Sinker, 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 sinker. And then, you know, curveballs and sliders that look the same. We talked about how he made the adjustment with his slider and was throwing it harder and almost scrapping the curveball entirely, which was good. And then on the Canada Day game against Cleveland, he threw more cutters than sinkers for the first time ever. And he went 6 2/3 and gave up a run. And then against the Royals, he threw 40% sliders and cutters, 48%. And it's like, okay, so he's realized that he really needs to change it up, keep hitters off balance. And that all went away in his next start against Oakland. And he threw 60 sinkers, which was, I think, I can't remember exactly how many pitches he threw, but it was, you know, it was over 60% of his pitches were sinkers.
And it sunk him.
Yeah, and he got crushed. I mean, obviously he was elevating some of them, but you can't go that way. Through 95 pitches, 60 of which were sinkers. So, I mean, when he's doing that, he gets hit. The reason that everyone expected so much of him was because of this grouping of pitches that he's got, you know, that are all so good. And if he's just throwing one of them, well, unless you're Aaron Sanchez and doing it at 97 miles an hour, it's hard to get things done.
Aaron Sanchez is crazy to watch him. I mean, I watched him live. You can see it, a lot of pitchers. You have to look up at the scoreboard to see what they just threw. But whenever I watch Sanchez, I could see halfway to the plate. It's like, oh, curveball. Yep. Oh, changeup. That was the fastball. And the way the hitters reacted to it was very much, oh, crap, it's a fastball. Yeah, so all that going on with Sanchez, it's such a huge contrast. It's amazing that he throws as many fastballs as he does, and they still cannot square it up.
Well, I just want to finish with Stroman quickly, because you were talking like what Sanchez can do this, right? He still makes minor adjustments, Sanchez. I wrote a piece for Baseball Perspectives Toronto about this. Like, from when he's facing a team a second time, he does work differently, which was interesting to see. Even when he dominates them the first time, it's like, well, let's give you something a little different. But Stroman can't do just a little different, right? Because he doesn't throw 97 like Sanchez with 9-inch break. So against Arizona, in the start where he went 8 innings and gave up a run, he mixed it up again. And it's like, oh, he had success. He threw 24 four-seam fastballs, 14 sliders, 11 cutters, you know, in his 99 pitches. And, you know, the four-seam fastball up, we've talked about that for him to get strikeouts, but he's changing it up, giving people different looks, different eye levels, and it works. He can't go back to the sinker baller again.
And I think you're still going to get ground balls out of that pitch mix, even if it's not specifically the sinker, which he did today against Arizona.
Sure.
And the other thing is, if you want a guy who uses a wide variety of pitches to achieve, a good end, he doesn't really have to look farther than Jay Happ to do that, does he?
Well, I mean, Jay Happ is the perfect example. His stuff is nowhere near as good as Stroman's, but he's so unpredictable with what he's going to throw that he's able to get outs. And when you add in this stuff, it makes it even easier to get out. So stop just throwing sinkers.
Well, he appears to have. We're heading in a direction that you have to like. It's not a ballooning ERA all the time now. So we'll see if he tightens it up as August approaches.
Yeah, his ERA is under 5 now.
Woo! okay, so the Blue Jays are getting closer to first place. Part of that is because the Blue Jays are playing half-decent baseball, but part of that, I guess, is the Red Sox have not run away with the division like they were in April and early May. Baltimore is in first. I still don't understand how Baltimore is in first place with one guy in the starting rotation, but I think I said that last week.
Although, since you've said that, they've not been playing as well.
Well, I'm saying it again. Gosh darn it.
As we're recording this, the Yankees are losing the Baltimore is losing to the Yankees again after having lost two in a row and lost to the Rays. And the AL East is really tight. So as we're recording this again, Baltimore and Boston are both playing. Boston is winning 8-0, so they're going to win that game. Mm-hmm. And if Baltimore loses, the three teams will be separated by one game.
Total.
With Boston in first place, Baltimore in second, and the Jays in third.
that's what you want, right? You want as close as possible and the optimal result of as much confusion as you can get at the top of your division. If with this wild card format, I'm all for confusion.
Yeah, well, you want to win, all right? The division is so important, right? And if you can keep yourself close when you have the talent, then that's what you want, at least until you can augment your team. Obviously, like right now, I would say the Blue Jays have the best team in the division.
Now, you say that despite the fact that the Red Sox keep madly shuffling people around and trading and putting people on the roster. They put
That's why I said right now.
But they put Brad Ziegler on. And they
Andrew
lost.
Pomeranz.
But they lost Craig Kimbrel.
Yes, for 4 to 6 weeks. And yeah, they added Drew Pomeranz, which gets Clay Buchholz back out of the rotation. But they still have a weak starting rotation, and their bullpen is not nearly as strong as it was. Carson Smith, who they thought was going to be a key piece, is out for the season with Tommy John. And as we established, Baltimore has no starting pitching, and their hitting has come back to earth.
Did Koji Uehara not get hurt last night or come out of the game?
If he did, I didn't catch that. I thought he finished the game off.
No, I heard. Yeah, see. This is why we do research, you know, live.
But anyway, this isn't the general point I was making, though. The point is that, oh yeah, he strained his pec. But the point is that the Jays are, in my opinion, the most talented team right now. But a lot can change over the next 2 weeks. So it's important, as you said, like to stay close and get as much space and as distance as you can, because we saw what happened last year when a team makes changes to the deadline.
And that team, of course, was the one we all are cheering for, and it worked out famously. But
And we're hoping, of course, that they do it again this year. I mean, there's no real reason this team can justify for not adding at least a relief pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, they managed to add one without too much disruption. One who even Grilly even has an option for next year. I was just reading, so you would think
for $3 million, yeah,
it's not a great stretch to add another one. You would hope. They will get a little bit better, though, right? Possibly on Monday?
Yeah. It sounds like Jose Bautista will be back for the start of the San Diego series, which is amazing news. It sort of came out of nowhere. It's like, oh, no, we don't know when he's going to return. We don't know when he's going to return. He's going on a rehab assignment. He's going to be back Monday. Okay.
He is so angry at his toe that he hit a home run in his first at bat in Dunedin.
Yeah.
Because we know when Jose Bautista is angry, he hits home runs.
That's definitely his MO. But I mean, that's a huge reinforcement if he comes back and is playing at full strength when he comes back, because the lineup is hitting now as it is, and he's second, third best hitter in this lineup and one of the top, 15 hitters in the game?
Yeah, and this lineup has not really missed a beat without him there. I'm not complaining about him coming back. It's amazing that they've continued to score runs and move the line. It was fantastic.
Which makes you think what they can be with him in it, right?
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Of course. But I mean, Tulowitzki still continues to hit, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah, I'm not complaining. We do have one other mystery possibly returning to the big club, and that is the formerly suspended Chris Colabello has begun taking swings in the minor leagues.
His situation is very interesting. I mean, as you mentioned, suspended for steroids, and that means he cannot play in the postseason. And the reason that that's important is because, I mean, okay, obviously you have to get there first, and that's where he could be coming into play if he starts hitting in the minors. And, you know, he is. But you don't want a guy who's a key cog in your lineup who all of a sudden you have to take him out when the games start to matter the most.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably the reason why that adjustment to the suspension rule came into play, right? That was... The debate was about whether Melky Cabrera would come back for the Giants, right?
Yes, that was right before he was the free agent, yeah.
Yeah, and then they said, okay, next year, you can't... It's not even going to be a debate. You can't bring him back. It's kind of a weird rule, but yeah, it does produce that... If you get a lineup that's clicking and it's got Chris Colabello in it every, two out of every 3 days, because he's a better option than Justin Smoke at first base... All of a sudden, he disappears, and now how rusty is Justin Smoke in September if that's what you did?
Yeah, and especially with Justin Smoke, too, because there's a big difference between his performance when he's playing every day and when he's not, when he's playing every few days with Edwin at first and whoever. He's just much worse when he's coming off the bench because he's a guy who doesn't make contact that much as it is.
Absolutely. So that kind of brings us, I believe, to the end of our week in review.
Yeah, I'd say we summed it up, but basically, come back, Jose. We miss you.
We miss you and we love you. All right, so looking forward, I think a little bit, we'll be talking to Adam McInturf in just a few seconds about all them prospects that might bring back what the Blue Jays need. Be right back. And we are pleased to be joined by Baseball Prospectus' own Adam McInturf. Adam, welcome to Artificial Turf Wars.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. Glad
to have you. So you are part of the scouting department over at Baseball Prospectus, and we're going to get your thoughts on some of the Blue Jays folks. But I guess first, how does one become a scout in a professional context? I'm kind of curious what career path led you there.
Well, I think it's different. Maybe what led me there is not. It's not like the way that I became a scout was the one unilateral path that people become scouts. It's an interesting, I think, kind of subset of the baseball operations community, because there are a lot of different avenues. I think they kind of get you to the same end. So I don't know. How do people get into scouting, or how did I personally get into scouting?
How did you get into it?
Okay. Well, me personally, I think that I was good enough at baseball to play with young men that were very good, and thus I realized that I was not great. I had a real passion for it always. I kind of grew up reading a lot of Baseball America. I went off to school, and when I went off to school, I actually bought speaking of Baseball America again, I bought the Baseball America directory, which, handily enough, a good tip given to me by a friend and mentor. I was about 18 or 19, right when I was heading to school. I looked up every area scout. And the directory generally is very good about giving the areas they cover. And where I was going to attend college, that being the University of Kentucky, I tried to initiate correspondence. I don't know. I should have used the word I know. But I tried to get in touch with area guys and see if there was an opportunity for us to at least have just basic conversations about scouting, or basically, you know, ask them what you asked me, you know, what's the way to get into scouting and express an interest in it. My goal was hopefully that I kind of knew that it was the type of thing that built upon itself in terms of your mental database of players, as it were. That's kind of the phrase that's accepted, the mental database of players. So knowing that takes time, and there's no substitute really for time and experience when it comes to a subjective matter like scouting, I wanted to start my clock early. I wanted to start building my group of players early. So I was lucky enough to help out an area scout as an associate scout for 2 years. Then after my sophomore year, I took one of these internships where, you know, you're a video intern and you spend a lot of time with a video camera, as you would imagine. I think over time, different experiences or different formative experiences start to build that base of players. And from there, whether you're scouting for a team or otherwise, you know, whether it's some other experience that I've had on the team side, which has been great, I've been lucky to have, you know, you always want to continue to expand that base. And so whether it's me, what I do now for Baseball Prospectus, or whether it's for a team, I think you're always just building on your mental database of players and trying to do your best to compare what you're seeing to what you have seen in the past, and try and match up the differences and similarities between the two, and try and, or at least that's kind of how I describe it. I don't know if this is an overly wordy thing, we can cut this down. I'm sorry, but that would be kind of what I think builds over time. And what I try to build over time in various experiences working with professional teams.
It's interesting. I'm curious. Are there certain levels and age groups that you find easier to scout than others?
So, yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if it's easier, but I think that the inputs that you use to come to your final conclusion about a player. I think maybe if you were to think about it in a way where like a different linear weight is attached to different inputs, different parts of information that kind of come together to form the end grade, I think you might focus on different things at different levels. So, for instance, at the AA level, I mean, the most basic thing I'm saying, like at the high minors level, I think that I probably, I'm not saying like I exclusively use statistics, but I might be more mindful of certain statistical tendencies or overall levels of success versus I think like when, you know, I saw Bluefield, who I'm sure we'll talk about in this podcast, when I saw the Bluefield Jays. I think at that level in the Appalachian League or the Gold Coast League Blue Jays or something like that, you really are fully scouting almost. I mean, something I thought when I was watching Arizona League baseball a few years ago, this was just like amateur baseball, but with tools. But otherwise, the process to evaluate a player is very, very subjective, and it's very rooted in the tools and projection that you see. And I think as guys get older and closer to the major league level, you can take in some objective and quantifiable information in a way that you probably couldn't at the lower level. So I don't know what's easier, but I'd say at least it's different. And I definitely recognize and understand that difference between the high and low minors.
Oh, cool. That's actually a really interesting answer. Thank you for that. So I guess
thank you for a really interesting question.
See, I just ask these questions so I can get compliments back.
Yeah, no, that's a great reason to ask questions. I agree.
So I figure, you know, we are a Blue Jays podcast, and you have been scouting a bunch of teams, as you said. So why don't we shift things a bit with the trade deadline coming up? Obviously, people are going to be Jays fans specifically are going to be interested in which prospects are doing what and who teams might covet. So, well, why don't we start at the top down, just based on from what you just said. The big guy at AA, my understanding, and you can obviously correct me from this on this if I'm wrong, would be Rowdy Tellez. He's young for the league. He's only 21, but he's putting up pretty good numbers. Is what we're seeing with the numbers matching what you're seeing there?
Yeah, I think especially in the power department. And in terms of him being the big guy, I definitely would agree he is the big guy. He's quite a big dude. He's, you know, a 6'4", 240-pound corner type of profile. And he's left-handed. And when you have that type of size and, you know, I think natural leverage in your swing, I think he's been a guy since amateur days. I saw him play in high school, and I saw him play this season as well. And he's always had a feel to hit, and it looks like he really enjoys hitting, and he has had a professional demeanor in the box for a long time that has outshadowed his actual age. So some of the success he's having, it doesn't surprise me at all. I know it's been it's always elating. Wasn't he he was a late round guy that got overpaid, I believe, or not?
He was a tough sign that fell out of the top 10 rounds. Yes,
but he was valued he was valued financially, you know, with a round higher than, I believe it was the 30th, or it was in the 30s. And it's always enthusing when, you know, a player development project like that, or a guy that fell out of the top 10 rounds, you're actually able to get a deal done and get that guy in your system and start to see him having success. And that's a credit, obviously, to the player and the Blue Jays scouting staff, too, to kind of cultivate this, you know, potential regular, solid regular at best at a corner from a sign like that in the draft. But, you know, I think I really like the power. I believe in the power. And if there's something that I think gives trepidation, it's probably just the feel to hit. But he's so young. And, you know, I'm sure I don't have to tell you guys that age relative to level is always a factor to consider as well. And So he's talented. He's got raw power, which is a tool that honestly, frankly, with as big as he is and with some of the aspects of his swing, it's, you know, he's always going to hit the ball hard. He's always going to hit the ball far. It's just a matter of how much he hits the ball, if that makes sense. And, you know, I think some of the things that might, you know, give anyone hesitation about him hitting the ball, you can obviously make, you know, to put it simply, you can make the argument that there's certainly plenty of time for him to remedy some of those things. I think left-handed pitching, I don't know. I'm sure, again, you guys probably are much more familiar with the splits. I do review them, but I don't know. I'm sure you guys have seen them more recently, but I think he's a guy that struggles against lefties, and he might be, I don't know. I remember feeling as though he might've been more pull oriented, but again, these are saying that these shouldn't be adjustments and these things should be fixed. And he checks a lot of big lead boxes, and he has a lot of attributes that you see on guys playing first base every night in the major leagues offensively, for sure.
Well, we're certainly happy to hear that. And for the record, he does struggle mightily statistically against lefties. So,
yeah,
for the
record, his swing has that look.
For the record, I don't.
His swing has that look too, yeah.
I don't ever actually know these things or look at splits.
Yeah, Greg is not big on the minor leaguers. Well, this is why we have people like you on, so can
exactly.
And I guess the other guy that is now on the Fisher Cats and did not start there, which actually surprised many people, that had got a lot of preseason hype, was Connor Green. Have you had a chance to see him since he's been up with New Hampshire?
Yeah, I have, and he's an exciting pitching prospect. I would chance that he is perhaps their best pitching prospect at what's considered a high level of minors. Would you agree with that, or would you say he's in that mix?
I think that that's definitely in the conversation for sure. It depends on what you consider high level. Like, is high A at high level? Because I think Reed Foley would be in the conversation there, but otherwise, no.
Yeah, no, I guess, I don't know. Maybe I don't know why I arbitrarily think that high minors is double A and triple A, but I've always, and that would be confusing because high is actually in the name in high A, but I meant double A and triple A.
Yeah, I think that's the standard definition, but yes, I think he's definitely the best one in that grouping.
Cool. I have seen him this year. And he's an exciting pitching prospect. I mean, he's what they look like physically and with his stuff. I mean, there's no denying that he's an athletic, really fast, loose arm, 6'3" or 6'4" build. He's not, you know, huge, but he's not really lean either. I mean, he has the features of a hard throwing guy that can eat innings. And same thing, like I said about Rowdy Tellez's power, he has, you know, Rowdy has big raw tools that at the end of the day, raw tools kind of just are. Like, if you have a good fastball and, you know, flashes of a swing and miss breaking ball, you're going to be able to flash those generally when you execute your pitches. And there's no denying the stuff. I mean, I've seen him, 93 to 97, 98, I think. I heard last week in a start, he was throwing, he touched 97, 98. And he'll flash a really good breaking ball. I mean, he'll flash a swinging miss kind of power curveball. And with a lot of young arms, I think the thing that he is working on is refining the consistency of his mechanics and then refining the consistency of his ability to set up hitters, because you'll see it. I mean, you see it. And then, you know, with a lot of young pitchers, there'll be sequences that he'll fall out of, or he'll maybe lose the feel for staying on top of his breaking ball such that it gets its best spin. Or maybe he sometimes the zone. I saw a start that the zone got away from him a little bit early on in the game. But, you know, again, he's a really, you know, the talent is there, the frame is there, and the stuff is there, and there's a lot of attributes to work with. And he's a very young arm at the level. And it's, you know, a lot of enthusing signs in a guy that, if it clicks in the best case, has the look of, you know, the two or three pitches that can mismatch the big league level as a starter.
And so, based on that report you just gave, is this the type of guy that if a team comes asking for him, that the team would feel potentially like, ooh, we don't want to give up this guy? Or is it like, you know what, there's enough risk that we can afford to, assuming you're getting someone good back?
Yeah, well, of course. I think you're always, I think at the time that you make any trade, you think that you're obtaining an asset that holds more value in your specific situation. I think if you didn't, then you wouldn't probably move any of your assets for assets in exchange that you're less comfortable with. But, you know, I think that, I don't know. I think it just depends on every team's situation. It depends on the trade, and it depends how much, you know, maybe internally where they view his ceiling. It certainly wouldn't surprise me if he were a guy they wanted to hold on to. But by the same token, it wouldn't surprise me if he was one of the very first names that, you know, the Blue Jays front offices might be fielding calls about if any teams are interested in prospects. And, you know, maybe that would be a position that they're in, you know, as a team that might be looking to add win-now talent at the big league level, you know, such that he's definitely a talent in their system that could be a part of a package like that, definitely.
No, oh, all right. Well, that's definitely answers the question. Well, we're going to, I guess, leave New Hampshire for a little bit. You said you did get a chance to see the Midwest League? Lansing?
Yeah, I did see Lansing. I saw Pentecost.
Well, that's good. We're going to ask you about him.
Well, yeah, I'm going to ask you how to pronounce his name. Pentecost?
Pentecost, I believe.
It's always been one of, you know, baseball, minor league baseball's greatest existential questions.
I think it would be the price of something.
Yes, the Pentecost of something. Okay. Thank you.
So Pentecost was a first round selection, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, 11th overall.
Yes, at a Kennesaw State. That was the year they had Jeff Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. Hasn't panned out exactly, because we're asking about a guy in the high minors so far. So what have injury. You seen from him? Yeah, a lot of injury.
Yeah, I think that I don't know how you want to split the tape with this. I was about to say, like, at the very least, it hasn't just been he hasn't performed, you know? So yeah, I feel like you can look at that one of two ways, right? Because I think that if it's a guy that's been injured, you can always hold out hope that they're still young. I mean, you know, sometimes I think when you scout college and high school guys, you get this habit of feeling like college guys are old men. And then you realize that they're still 21 years old at the time that you're picking them, or most of them anyway. 20 to 22 years old, most of them 21. So that's still, in the grand scheme of things, is, you know, fairly young for a minor league player. And there are plenty of 22-year-olds. I believe Rowdy Tellez is right around that age that are just in double-A. That were drafted from high school. And, you know, so you hope that, like you said, I think there's been a lot of injuries. I unfortunately did not get to see him catch much, which I was very interested in doing, but I was interested in seeing him overall, knowing that he had rebounded from some physical issues. And I liked a lot of the hitting tools, actually. I liked the way the hands worked at the plate and the shortness of the swing and the way that I thought that he covered the inside part of the plate. I had the benefit of seeing him have a pretty good series as well, where he hit a lot of balls hard and hit a pretty long home run to the pole side too. But in terms of, you know, being an athletic guy with good balance in his base and a flat swing that's short to the ball and can dip backspin for some average and power, I thought he kind of had some of the check marks offensively, tools wise, that you're looking for to throw that label on somebody. But like I said, you know, I didn't see him catch, and I think he's not, you know, I believe anyway, he did not look to me. He looked like a guy that will both hit and hit for a little bit of power, but not necessarily a masher. So it seemed like maybe his best opportunity for that bat to hold its, you know, highest upside profile would be as catcher. So I don't know if you guys have heard anything about his defense behind the plate.
Well, he's still DHing only right now.
Okay, well, that would explain why I didn't see him catch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he did not catch in DH. He just, you know, DH. But I liked the hitting tools. I mean, you know, I liked some of the hitting tools, and it was a guy that if I were a scout and I were to be writing up a report, I would, you know, take note of the fact that despite the fact he had some injuries and he was a first-round college guy that still is, and Lansing, I would at least take note that maybe he's one of the guys that shows some of the tools offensively that gives you the hope that if the injuries are behind him, he can put some things together pretty quickly and make up time.
So the other guy that you had mentioned there briefly was Harris. Now, Jesse Goldberg-Strassler, I follow on Twitter, and we've talked to him before. He raves about Harris and the potential there. Did you get a chance to see him? You know,
yes.
Do you agree?
I did it, and I saw him good, but he's had a lot of quality starts. You know, I like I said, you know, we talked about New Hampshire, I see double-A baseball. I saw Lansing. I see more low-A baseball in the South Atlantic League, Midwest League, but, you know, that's both low-A full-season leagues. And frankly, you know, Harris did not look that different or that much further behind than any – most of the quality prospects pitching at double A. I mean, I'll put it this way. There's some more refined attributes of his strike throwing and pitchability right now than Connor Green. And, you know, I don't think, I'm still not saying he's better. I'm just saying, like, he's, you know, but he also pitched in college. So, you know, that's maybe the give and take. He's older than Connor Green, or maybe the same age. I don't know. But, I saw the ceiling. I think it's a good combination of a guy that does have some swing and miss pitches, field his own, but also has a pretty high floor. Like I said, there's a lot of things he was doing pretty well and pretty advanced in terms of knowing how to use his pitches, tunneling, keeping his off-speed pitches, I should say, which is called tunneling, keeping the off-speed pitches on a similar plane as the fastball, and being able to pitch with different sequences and strategies, not just pitching the lineup fastball, curveball every time. You know, he looks like a guy that could be a number three starter, but again, I think some of the upside is just how polished he is. And you see him, and he definitely has that big league look about, you know, a 6'5 guy with three solid quality pitches, and he knows how to use them. And that definitely stands out in the Midwest League for sure. And I saw him pitch very well against Lake County.
Okay, so as I pointed out earlier, I'm not a prospects guy, but I just briefly, you may not have seen him, but the one name that I get to hear all over the place on the internet is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. What is the buzz outside of our little bubble of Blue Jaydom about Vlad Jr. and what he might have going on in, I believe it's Vancouver?
Yeah, I have seen Vlad Guerrero Jr., which I haven't. I see the Appy lead for a short season lead. I have not seen all the teams. I'm working on putting together an entire lead piece for when I do, and that's about 65% of the way done, put an arbitrary number on it. But I have seen Bluefield. And, you know, the hype on him, I think it's real in terms of having – I mean, you know, if we say this is Vlad Guerrero Jr., and then we say this is a really strong-bodied guy with just crazy bat speed and just unusual hand-eye coordination and bat to ball with a lot of raw power, who takes a huge swing. And, you know, sometimes it's learning how to channel that, tone that down. But the times where he's toned down and he's able to tap into his contact, the power is just absurd. A very strong throwing arm too. So it's like, huh, I feel like we've heard that before when it comes to the name Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Obviously I'm not likening him to his dad, because I think you never want to, you know, it just wouldn't be something to do. But in terms of a tool set, I think he's a little shorter than his dad, but the muscular frame, he's like just a very, like, you know, you see a lot of 18 and 19 year olds in the Appy League, and he's actually 17, I believe. I think he is 17 or an early 18, and he's a lot more just physically developed, just a really physical, kind of has that big league athletic corner outfielder look to him. I actually saw him play third, I believe. Has he played exclusively third since signing?
I think that's where they have him, yes.
Well, he had a strong arm there. Again, you know, whether it's third or the outfield, you know, it's not like he's a shortstop or center fielder. So it's the bat that's going to carry him. And it's really the bat, I think, that justifies the hype and the bonus, just in terms of the strength that he has and the quickness and whip and his bat speed. You know, he's a guy, same thing. I must have had the hot hand seeing Blue Jays prospects hit home runs. But I saw Vlad Guerrero have a very good series and get into a couple. And again, you know, he'll have at bats, like he'll have at bats in the same game, one of which where he gets his front foot down early and is able to really turn on the fastball. And there are times where it's, you know, he's in an 0-2 count and he swings at a curveball for strike three, like it's, you know, a 3-1 fastball. You know, it's both, and it's polarized by the same token. That's kind of what I was saying about how you want to get away from some more objective and statistical measures at the low minors. His age at his level and the tools that he has, he does a lot of things that you just don't see a lot of 17-year-olds doing right now. He has a lot of present ability, and he really looks the part when he gets a hold of one.
Well, there's certainly some hopes riding on him since they blew the entire, you know, they're not allowed to sign any guys this year over 300,000 because of him. So they're definitely asking a lot of Vlad Guerrero Jr.
Yeah, it's true, and that's always a risk when you're, you know, rolling the dice at the top of the market on July 2nd. You're always, you know, you're gonna, there's plenty of high dollar guys that have come from the international signing period and from the Dominican, Venezuela, and others in Latin America, and they haven't panned out. And there have been guys, you know, that get paid a lot and it does pan out, and there are guys somewhere in between. So that's always kind of a risk that you take, but he does have, you know, I saw him and Adrian Rondon as another impact or considered impact seven-figure international signing. He's also 17. And, you know, I'd say both of those guys showed the reason why there aren't many 17-year-olds in the Appy League except for these top-dollar ones. It's just there are things about Vlad and the others that stand out when you're at that age and that level.
Well, that's pretty cool. So before we let you go, though, is there someone that we, as, you know, people who follow most of the big league team and pay attention to prospects, but now that aren't like the big names, that someone has stood out to you?
Yeah, a guy that's been getting a lot of buzz. Where have we gone? We've gone Bluefield, West Virginia, and New Hampshire. So we'll go to Vancouver. the Canadians in the Northwest League, there's a pitcher named Justin Maese that, I believe that's the correct pronunciation, right?
I'm pretty sure that is right, yes.
Yes, okay. Just, you know, double checking. He's been terrific. He's been a projection right-handed guy, high school right-handed kid. And, you know, same thing, like, maybe to different degrees, but like when you're dealing with top of the market international 16-year-olds, when you're dealing with high school pitching, and as you know, the Blue Jays have demonstrated an affinity for high school pitching, you know, for some time, I would say, it's safe to say. He's one of the prep arms, like Connor Green, too. Connor Green was not a first-round guy, but a guy that really projected large and took steps in that positive direction. So often with that demographic, you see, quote, projectable guys that don't do that much more projecting out. But just in my essay, I've heard has come a significant ways. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. He was a high-round pick from them from rural Texas, or fairly rural Texas, not the Dallas Metroplex area or another area, I believe in West Texas. And
yeah, from El Paso.
Yes. A three-sport athlete. And, you know, same thing. I think in high school he was a, you know, live arm guy with a good frame that flashed some stuff and flashed athleticism such that you thought he could make adjustments, but he's made a lot of those adjustments and everything's up. The stuff is up. I have not seen him. I've heard, though, and it's easy to believe, and I've heard from a few people that he's been picked up on his fastball to the point where he's now anywhere from 92 to 95 or 96. That's a very lively pitch. To the Denny, he is athletic and he's pretty smooth with the way his arm works over the top. He's showing the ability to make guys swing and miss with a breaking ball, a hard, tight slider, and actually throwing a slider pretty hard for a kid that age too, throwing like a real mid-80s power slider that really, you know, has flashed pretty good at times. And he's throwing a lot of strikes. And for me, this is just a personal thing, but when a young pitcher, I believe, yes, this is his first full season of professional baseball. He was a 2015 draftee, and I guess he started in extended if he went to Vancouver, but when a young kid like this is able to both have athleticism on a big lead-looking frame, has some stuff, and throws strikes, I mean, I think that's where, you know, projection and pop-up guys come from that become go from having tools to being real big lead prospects, and I think he might be one of the guys that makes that jump for them this year.
Well, if we keep our eye out for him.
Yeah. All right. So as Johnny Cash once said, I've been everywhere, man. And I think we've been all around the Blue Jays minor league system with that.
Yeah.
At this point, I usually give our guests an opportunity to plug their Twitter handle if they wish to do so. Do you wish to do so?
Well, I guess when you put it like that, I do have a Twitter, which I'm getting, you know, I'm getting better. I was not much of a Twitter guy previously before this, but yes, Twitter, WAdam_McIntyr, McIntyrff. I don't know. I think spelling was helpful with the last name like that, but it's been really fun to work with a great group of guys here on the BC prospect team, and we just released our top 100, or top 50, I should say, top 50 midseason prospects. And that was a really fun collaborative effort that a lot of work went into from all of our guys, and that's something that I know we're proud of. There certainly were 20 of these Blue Jays prospects even on the list in consideration. So,
all right. We appreciate you dropping by, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Glad all right. Take care. And we're back, and we'd like to thank Adam McIntyrff of Baseball Perspectives for joining us and offering a little perspective on the Blue Jays minor leagues. And we're moving on. We're moving on to...
Back to the big leagues.
Back to the big leagues for one big league question. Really? Did we catch you unawares tonight, people? One fantastic question. Would you like to read the question?
Sure. So this question comes from Blue Jay Way 1. What creature do we have to sacrifice to improve the Jays' luck in one-run games?
And a very serious question as well, obviously.
They know the tone of our podcast.
Indeed. I've always thought Kentucky Fried Chicken was really... It wasn't a sacrifice, per se, but ever since Major League, that's the food I think of when I think of clubhouse sacrifices.
But if you're going to quote that movie, Willie Mays Hayes should have gotten a live chicken.
It didn't help Jan Gomes. Jan Gomes had the worst luck in the world. They sacrificed something for him, and then he hurt his shoulder. So,
so stick with the KFC.
Yeah, we're gonna go with KFC. I'd like to acknowledge the fact that it really is just luck in one-run games. That doesn't actually represent any actual skill.
I think that at some point it does, just because like if you have a good bullpen, you'll probably win more than like a really good bullpen, or if you have a really bad bullpen, it'll sway it. And the Jays have a pretty bad one. But yeah, in general, I agree with you.
It has to be pretty extreme. And why not two-run games? You're still putting your best reliever in when there's two-run lead, right? You're not putting some garbage time guy in. So why do we only care about one-run games? I don't know. Seems weird to me. We had another comment from Brendan Kuhn. He was thinking about us when Matt Devlin was doing the broadcast. He said Devlin could have his own version of swinging a drive from one game alone, excitable with anything that reaches the outfield.
Okay, so here's the thing. Calling the play is really hard, and Matt Devlin has no training at it. He's done it, but like he's a basketball guy.
And pretty much every time the ball goes in the air in basketball, something exciting is happening. That's the rules of that game, as I understand it.
Right. Whereas Buck has been around this for a long time. So we don't give him the same benefit of the doubt that we give to Devlin.
Fair enough. I actually enjoy Matt. To be honest, I like sort of the rhythm of his voice and the way he calls the game. So I'm sure his familiarity with how to call a baseball game does leave him a little lacking, but I definitely think he could be a good guy if they wanted him for some reason more consistently, just personally.
Mm-hmm. No, I think he's got the talent. It's just he doesn't have the experience. That's all.
And Buck has the experience, but okay, moving right along. You had a do-over?
Yeah. Mr. John Paul Morosi is back to his Blue Jay fan baiting ways. He was really all over it this week. First, earlier in the week, he was suggesting that the Blue Jays should look at trading just Josh Donaldson.
We're not a hard bunch to bait, though, are we? Really?
No, apparently not, because we're talking about it on the podcast. But which I mean, it's just like, yeah, it's like even if they traded him next year, he's not a free agent after 2018. There's no reason whatsoever to trade Josh Donaldson.
Well, they're a game and a half out of first. Even if things go badly tonight, why would you get rid of your very best? What are you going to trade him for?
It's just stupid. I don't even want to go this any further. I just wanted to mention it was dumb that he brought it up. Let's not give it the credence it deserves by going any further into why it doesn't make sense. But he didn't stop there. He went on, I guess not doubling down, but he just decided to go deeper. So saying that it looks like the Jays are preparing for life after Encarnacion. That was part of the Smoke signing and why they want to keep Rowdy Tellez. Justin Smoke ain't replacing Edward Encarnacion. Nobody believes that. And Rowdy Tellez is a prospect. He's a decent one. Of course, they want to keep him, but it's not because they're going to lose Edwin. It's because he's pretty decent.
It goes on. They report, of course, once again on the All-Star break, they report that Edwin isn't negotiating in season. Like it's news. It's not news. It was in spring training. Edwin said, "I'm not going to negotiate during the season. Thank you." Okay. I guess we're done here. Why has that come up at the All-Star break? That makes no sense at all.
It's just people know that Jays fans will read anything. And Jay's idiot podcasters will talk about anything.
And then people will listen to Jay's idiot podcasters talking about anything. This is the best.
What are these jerks doing a do-over? Jeez.
All right. So, yeah. John Paul Morosi, your do-over is if you stop talking about absolutely illogical things that the Jays might do, we won't ever talk about it again. I did see a tweet that I thought was accurate. Some pundits / analysts, whatever you want to call them, wish every team was constantly rebuilding because then they would have
stuff to write about.
Yeah, endless material, right? Because people would be moving around all the time.
That was in response to the Donaldson comments.
Yeah, but someone has to be winning now and hanging on to people. That's just the way it works. All right. So as a final point here, I'm going to give the floor over to you because you explained briefly to me, but I'd like you to go in as much detail as necessary as to why it's important that people come to peace with cheering for the New York Yankees.
Yeah. And this is a hard thing for people to wrap their head around, which I understand because the Yankees have been the enemy for ever. Is that right? Since the Jays have existed?
The evil empire.
Right, exactly. Well, there's a couple reasons that everyone should be cheering for the Yankees right now. First off, they're playing Baltimore at the moment. So Baltimore's in first place, and they're going to be playing the Red Sox a bunch, and they're not a big threat. These are the obvious reasons. But the other reason is that the Yankees, they face a lot of pressure to win, and they don't have a team that's probably good enough. But if they're even within striking distance of the postseason, it's going to be really, really hard for them to justify selling. And if they can't sell, then other teams in the league can't get better. And I'm all for this.
Okay.
Because they have pieces that the teams that the Jays are fighting will covet.
Yes. They have relievers who throw 105 miles an hour.
Yeah. And they've got outfielders for, say, Cleveland. They've got a couple of mediocre starting pitchers that are still better than Boston's guys. I mean, yeah, Yankees, Red Sox trades are rare, but that doesn't mean they don't happen. So, yeah, I'd like them to stay on the fringes just so that they blow it and then realize on August 2nd that, oh, crap, we should have sold.
So you're trying to...
Sorry, August 12th, because they play Boston from the 9th to the 11th.
Right. So you're trying to create, by force of will, and I mean, this could work, a situation where the Yankees help the Jays this year, and in doing so, screw themselves for the long term.
Yes, exactly.
Magic. Genius.
And by the way, that tweet you were talking about was from Mike. Go Sens Go.
Ah, it was. Mike, full credit there. Okay, well then, absolutely, go Yankees. Right.
And temporarily, go Yankees.
I think it's important that they get right around the 84 win mark, or they at least they're tracking for it, right? That's where they want to be.
Yeah,
because you can't sell when you're tracking for 84 wins, because anything could happen.
Exactly.
Of course, it probably won't, because after 10 years of being too old, the Yankees appear to have finally gotten too old.
But they're still holding on as of the podcast ending. It's 2-0 against the Orioles through 5. If they can get through one more inning with that lead, they can go to Betances, Miller, and Chapman, who threw 105 again, by the way.
Again.
Like he tied his own record for the fastest pitch ever at 105.1.
Like it ain't no thing. I don't even... Yeah, it just blows my mind. Okay, so on that go Yankees go note, I think it's time to wrap up our loose ends. First of all, you are Josh Howsam, and you can be found at Joshua Howsam. I am Greg Wisniewski, and I can be found at Coolhead2010. Our guest was Adam McIndurf of Baseball Prospectus.
And he can be found at WAdam_McIndurf.
Indeed. And this has been Artificial Turf Wars episode number 21. And we will see you next week.